Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and on the afternoon of Monday, the 15th of July, these are our main stories. The former president of South Africa, Jacob Zuma, has appeared before a judicial inquiry, responding to corruption allegations against him. Hong Kong's chief of police has described pro-democracy demonstrators as thugs after a series of violent clashes over the weekend, which left dozens injured. The deadly Ebola epidemic in the Democratic Republic of Congo has reached the city of Goma, a major transportation hub with a population of 1 million. Also in this podcast, the image of the pioneering British computer scientist Alan Turing will appear on the Bank of England's new £50 notes.
As the father of computer science and artificial intelligence, Turing is a giant on whose shoulders so many now stand.
And the Philippines has declared a national alert for dengue fever, which has killed more than 400 people this year. Jacob Zuma stepped down as president of South Africa last year over claims that he had overseen a web of corruption while in power. Today, Mr. Zuma began giving evidence at a commission set up to probe state capture, a buzzword for the multiple scandals that engulfed his presidency. And he spoke about why he believed he faced so many corruption allegations.
The reason why we wanted to character assassinate the Zuma's character was because he has a lot of information that he holds. Among that type of information, as a chief of intelligence, there are spies that are infiltrated by us in his organization, whom we want to nurture, that they grow within the structures of the ANC, to a point that at some point they will have to lead the ANC. Now, Zuma has information about these. We don't know when will he use his information to stop that process, that plan of theirs. And therefore, they took a decision that Zuma must be removed from decision-making structures of the ANC.
Milton Nkosi has been following the proceedings in Johannesburg.
This commission is looking at a litany of corruption allegations against President Zuma during his presidency, one of which is that a deputy minister of finance in his cabinet was invited by President Zuma's private friends, the Gupta family, in their own residence in a suburb in Johannesburg, and they offered him the post of finance minister along a huge amount of money as bribe, so that he, when he's finance minister, he can look after their business interests. This person, MKBC Jonas, rejected the offer as he testified. President Zuma says the Guptas were name-dropping. He never arranged for them to do that. There were many other allegations. He called one of the government officials to help the Guptas when they come seeking assistance from him. Now, this government official said when the Guptas arrived, they wanted to take all his budget of advertising and put it into their own newspaper. And this was a budget for him to across other platforms like radio, television, and the internet. He found that completely shocking, he told the commission here. So President Zuma is answering to corruption allegations such as those ones and many others.
Yeah, so Mr. Zuma has denied any allegations against him, as have the Gupta brothers. Mr. Zuma said it was all character assassination. To what extent do you think many South Africans are sympathetic to that view?
Well, this is very intriguing because President Zuma is an anti-apartheid struggle hero here. He commands a huge amount of support from South Africans. Remember, he spent 10 years in prison fighting apartheid. So this, even if you don't believe what he says today, as many people are now saying on social media, this is a victimhood mentality that he's using. There are many others who say President Zuma is right because he was fighting for the right of black people and he was vilified for that. And that's why the corruption stigma and allegations are still hanging over his neck. So there are many others who would believe Mr. Zuma's version of events as he denies any wrong doing. But there are those who think he must answer specific to those details that we've heard in public about these corruption allegations when he was still president.
That was Milton Nkosi at the Commission into Jacob Zuma's alleged corruption. And those hearings are expected to last for several days. Hong Kong's police chief has condemned violence over the weekend that left dozens of people injured, some of them critically. Stephen Lowe described protesters who were involved in clashes at a shopping mall on Sunday as thugs, amid reports that police officers had been kicked and punched after falling to the ground. The pro-democracy campaigners in Hong Kong have been trying to keep up the momentum of recent mass protests against a controversial bill that would allow the Chinese government to extradite criminal suspects to the mainland. Our correspondent Danny Vincent is in Hong Kong.
People here in Hong Kong have been protesting for more than a month now. These protests began with opposition to this extradition bill, which has now, according to Carrie Lam, it's been suspended. But what we've seen in recent weeks is that protesters have tried to keep up the momentum of this movement. So over the weekend, some of the protests were not necessarily even related to the extradition bill. We saw a protest against mainland parallel traders in the northern part of Hong Kong. So it seems that protesters are using creative and innovative ways to keep the momentum going. But now it seems to be escalating and we're seeing much more violence. And what happened over this weekend were there were two relatively large clashes between police and between protesters. One was quite close to the mainland border in the north of the territory, and the other was still in the new territories, but a little bit more central in Hong Kong. What we saw was police and protesters standing off against each other, and eventually they came to clashes. Yesterday they had clashes inside a shopping mall. Now those images, those pictures have been all across Hong Kong media today, and the latest is that Carrie Lam, Hong Kong's leader, she's calling these protesters rioters, and that's something that many of the protesters have been trying to have this word actually retracted from her past comments.
Danny Vincent in Hong Kong. In the past year, more than 1,600 people have died from Ebola in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Health officials in the Central African nation have long worried that the disease could spread to a large city, and now those fears appear to have been realised. A pastor who travelled by bus to Goma, a major transport hub with a population of around 1 million people, has been diagnosed with Ebola. The World Health Organization chief has said the development could be a game changer. And the microbiologist Peter Peart, who helped discover the Ebola virus in the 1970s, said it was time to step up the international response to the epidemic.
There is now a massive effort, and I must say there's local groups, international groups, the Congolese are doing everything they can. But this is an extraordinarily complex epidemic, with insecurity, the militias were there, mistrust in government. And so I think we need to really to reset this the strategy, because this has been going on for nearly a year. So we need to involve far more community, listen to people, but also deploy everything we have.
Well, Tarek Rebel is the Emergency Response Coordinator for the International Rescue Committee in Goma. He spoke to the BBC's Dan Damon about the arrival of Ebola in the city.
All of us are more than surprised that it's taken this long, given the movement of populations between the affected areas for the north and Goma, which is such a major hub for eastern Congo. I think we should note that overall, the case seems to have been dealt with very well. We applaud the health center staff that correctly identified that this person could be a suspect case, and alerted the Surveillance Commission. So in many ways, things did go well, and that is encouraging to see.
How easy will it be to track those people who were in the bus? This pastor came from North Kivu, and there were, I guess, a lot of people that he met on the way.
Yes, so from what we're hearing, there's already a list of the people on the bus that the Surveillance Commission has, and they are following up with all of them. A lot of these buses have manifest lists, so they actually do have the names and contacts of people that were on the trip. In terms of his time in Goma, it seems that he didn't spend a long time before going to the health center. So we're hoping that there aren't too many people he was in contact with in Goma. But of course, it's still early on, and we need to see what exactly the case investigation shows.
How hopeful then are you that the spread can be contained? From what you've said, it seems that's going to be almost impossible.
Exactly. I think there's a lot of measures in terms of points of entry at airports, at ports, and at the main national roads that enter Goma. We need to continue having those in place. We need to continue having surveillance at the local level, and then continue the preparedness at a health center level. The staff at this health center did a great job. But obviously, there's many, many health centers around Goma, about 1,000 in total. All of them need to be well aware of the risks in terms of receiving patients that could be suspect cases.
And there are the risks to those trying to help deal with the health crisis. Two further murders of health workers in North Kivu. How much does that hamper what you're trying to do?
The insecurity has been a key problem. We have an active acceptance strategy where we negotiate with all the different parts of the community. And we need to keep working on acceptance. We need to keep working at community engagement, reaching out to those that mistrust what we are doing, and also make sure that we are explaining our work in the best way possible.
Tarek Riebel speaking to Dan Damon. The governments of France, Britain and Germany have made a joint appeal to President Trump and Iranian leaders to ease the standoff over Iran's nuclear programme. The British Foreign Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, said there was still a chance that the international nuclear deal with Iran could be saved.
Iran is still a good year away from developing a nuclear weapon. We think there is still some closing but small window to keep the deal alive. And what we're looking for is to give Iran a way out of this so that they can get back into compliance with that nuclear deal, because we've been very clear that a deal is a deal. If they breach that deal, there's no sort of observing the deal in just in this part but not in that part. It has to be taken in its entirety, and we are clear that we need to see that deal being properly honoured.
The EU foreign ministers have been meeting in Brussels to discuss the issue. Our diplomatic and defence correspondent Jonathan Marcus has more.
The Europeans and the deal itself are caught between two great forces. On the one hand, the Americans, who've walked away from the deal, have reimposed secondary sanctions against Iran, and that economic pressure is really squeezing the Iranian economy. On the other, the Iranians, who want somebody to relieve that pressure, they're looking to the Europeans to do that, and it's very hard to see how Europe can make a significant impact to relieve that economic pain. And if they don't do that, the Iranians are saying they will continue in their gradual, step-by-step withdrawal from some of the agreement's provisions. And of course, as you heard there from Jeremy Hunt, the British Foreign Secretary, the difficulty for the Europeans is a sense at some point they have to declare this deal dead. They're going to delay it as long as possible. They're hoping against hope they can find some way of getting one or other, the Americans or the Iranians, to alter their position. But it's a very, very difficult diplomatic situation.
You mentioned there's a possibility that Iran will continue to withdraw from this agreement step by step, and that presumably is going to increase tensions in the region hugely.
Well, absolutely. It's going to increase tensions as part of Iran's response to the American pressure. They have upped tension in the Gulf. We've seen attacks on shipping. We've seen the very particular tensions between Britain and Iran, which are a sort of subset of that. Now, the Iranians, in some cases, accept what they're doing. In other cases, they deny that they've been involved in these attacks. But I think most people believe that the Iranians or somebody close to the Iranians has clearly had a hand in these. So the pressure isn't just diplomatically. There's the background danger that some untoward event in the Gulf, some misunderstanding, some clash between forces in what is a heavily armed region could precipitate what is a diplomatic crisis into some kind of all-out conflict.
Jonathan Marcus. Coming up in this podcast, the growth of China's economy has dropped to the slowest pace in nearly 30 years as the trade war with the US drags on. And
it's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Good job, Grandpa.
50 years after Neil Armstrong landed on the moon, his family open up about his little-known private life. Here in Britain, the computer pioneer and legendary codebreaker Alan Turing has been named as the new face on the £50 note. Alan Turing is most celebrated for his efforts in cracking the Nazi Enigma machine during World War II. But he was a gay man living at a time when homosexuality was illegal, and his career ended in the most desperate of circumstances. Here's Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, on the brighter points of Alan Turing's legacy.
Turing was an outstanding mathematician whose works had an enormous impact on how we live today. All around us, his legacy continues to build. Turing is a giant on whose shoulders so many now stand.
David Lewis told me more.
Alan Turing was a British mathematician who really played a crucial part in the Allied victory over Nazi Germany in World War II. After completing a maths degree at Cambridge University, he joined the government's top secret code-breaking department at Bletchley Park. There he developed a new machine which cracked the Nazi Enigma code and allowed the Allies to stay one step ahead of the enemy. Hitler always believed his army's messages could never be decoded. But in 1952, Alan Turing was arrested for what was described as gross indecency, for having an affair with a 19-year-old when homosexuality was illegal in Britain. He was given the choice, jail or chemical castration. He chose the procedure, but had his security clearance scrapped and was harassed by police surveillance after that. He went on to commit suicide by cyanide poisoning 2 years later and was given a royal posthumous pardon for his crime, 2013.
So redeemed, recognised, and now recognised on the note. How did he end up on it?
That's right. Well, the Bank of England wanted a great British scientist to go on the back of the new £50 note. They asked the public to suggest their preferred one. In 6 weeks, they received more than 200,000 nominations for hundreds of eligible scientists. Whittled down, the shortlist included people like Stephen Hawking, paleontologist Mary Anning, and physicist Ernest Rutherford. But Bank of England Governor Mark Carney made the final decision. And explaining it, he described Turing as a war hero. The note will contain a picture of Turing plus his signature from the visitor's book at Bletchley Park. Under his image, there'll be a quote that Turing gave to journalists, which was, the quote is, "This is only a foretaste of what is to come and only the shadow of what is going to be."
David Lewis. A national alert has been declared in the Philippines following the deaths of more than 400 people this year from dengue fever. The World Health Organization has said scaremongering over a dengue fever vaccine is partly to blame. Our Philippines correspondent Howard Johnson is in the capital city, Manila.
More than 100,000 cases of dengue infection have been recorded since the start of the year, according to the Philippine Department of Health, an 85% increase compared to the same period last year. The Philippines has recently been embroiled in a dispute over the safety of its dengue vaccination program. The previous government had stockpiled the vaccine Denvaxia, but later its manufacturer, Sanofi Pasteur, said it could increase health risks in cases where the patient hadn't suffered from dengue before. According to the World Health Organization, scaremongering about the product on social media is believed to have dissuaded many parents in the Philippines from using vaccines.
Howard Johnson. China has seen the growth of its GDP shrink to 6.2% in the second quarter of this year. For any other country, that level of growth would signal an economic boom. But for China, it's the slowest rate of expansion in three decades. Our Asia business correspondent, Karishma Vaswamy, is in Singapore. She spoke to my colleague, Joe Lynam.
It had been widely forecast, the fact that the figures were going to come in at around 6.2 or 6.3%. The headline figure itself, of course, is quite shocking for many people when you hear a number like, putting it, you know, into perspective, the slowest growth in almost three decades. That does tend to send some anxiety through investors. But take a look at some Asian markets today, you know, really shrugging that headline figure off, telling you that they understand that the data that's coming through from China, obviously indicating a slower growth trajectory. But because the government has widely forecast this, signaled this, in fact, lowering its official target rate earlier this year and been telling the market, look, this is going to be a tough year. This was widely expected. I think what we should worry about is whether Beijing has ample tools in its arsenal to be able to combat this kind of slowdown. But from previous years' experience, we certainly have seen the government there very well prepared. The Chinese central bank has gone into overdrive this year and is expected to do so again following this by cutting taxes and boosting spending to help shore up growth in the country.
So the country is in the middle of a bit of a change away from manufacturing-led growth, which has served it quite well for the last few decades, into a more consumption-led growth. And that means that the growth won't be as the double-digit growth that we saw in the early noughties, for example. And is that on target?
Yeah, pretty much so. I mean, in so much as Beijing has recognized that you can't keep growing at 10, 11%, right, Joe? I mean, all developed economies go through this. As a country gets richer, the growth rate gets lower, but that's because the size of the economy grows bigger. And that's what's happened in China. But throw into the mix the fact that now China's having to manage the very real risk of its trade tensions with the United States. And, you know, even though a lot of the focus has been going into consumption, as you point out, people buying more things in China. That's not really offsetting yet one of the main pillars of how China's economy has grown, and that's through exports. Across the country, hundreds of thousands of Chinese factories are being affected by this U.S.-China trade war because now they can't sell their products to the United States without a tax being on them. And that's making life very difficult for business sentiment as well as job hiring prospects.
Karishma Vaswamy speaking to Joe Lynam. 50 years ago this week, the U.S. astronaut Neil Armstrong became the first person to set foot on the moon. The 1969 lunar mission is considered one of the greatest achievements of human history. But Neil Armstrong shied away from fame, and to this day, the public has learned very little about him. Now, his family have spoken to our science correspondent, Palab Ghosh, about the late Apollo 11 hero, who they described as warm and funny and profoundly affected by having seen the Earth arise from the moon's surface.
The prime crew now departing from their crew quarters.
On his way to the launch pad, he was about to become the most famous person in human history. Yet since he set foot on the moon, the world learned little about the real Neil Armstrong.
Here they're in the suit-up room.
You really do look a lot like him, Dad.
Yeah. Thanks.
His son, Mark, was just 6 years old at the time.
Oh, Dad. Yeah,
little baby.
Cute and as a button.
50 years on and a world away, he relives those moments with his daughter, Kaylee.
Lights on. Forward.
Basically, Dad's controlling the vehicle and Buzz is calling off. How far down they go and how much fuel is left.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Good job, Grandpa.
He did not appear to be worried, and so we weren't worried. Okay, everything's going to be fine, and we'll see Dad in a month or so when he's out of quarantine. Dad was very much the same after as he was before. And both he and my mother wanted our lives to try to stay the same after as before. And that was a struggle.
His eldest brother, Rick, told me that it wasn't always easy being Neil Armstrong's son.
Everybody wants to be judged on their own merits, I think. I think I would have liked to have been an astronaut in the shuttle program, and maybe I didn't because I didn't want to have to face down that comparison.
At the time of the moon landing, through his eyes, millions across the world saw what he saw.
In 1969, he was looking back at the Earth and seeing it as a fragile resource. I wasn't alive, of course, for it. And so getting to relive it in my own generation is really, really special.
It's very pretty out here.
That was the family of Neil Armstrong speaking to our science correspondent, Palab Ghosh. And that's all from us for now. But there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles. Until next time, goodbye.
With the Capital One Saver Card, you can earn 4% cash back on dining and entertainment. That means 4% on checking out that new French restaurant and 4% on bowling with your friends. You'll also earn 2% cash back at grocery stores and 1% on all other purchases. Now when you go out, you cash in. Capital One. What's in your wallet? Terms apply.